Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 292 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Nicola Baldwin speaks with Amanda Whittington about the distinctive nature of radio drama, how the unique demands of the medium shape her writing, and why radio offers a radical way to tell stories by, for, and about women's lives.
Nicola Baldwin is a playwright and scriptwriter, director and sometimes producer, whose varied portfolio includes television, film, digital media, music video and theatre. She won the 1993 George Devine Award for Confetti, and her work continues to explore the complex and often contradictory aspects of women's lived experience, in themes ranging from so-called bogus brides to far-right radicalisation in 30s Britain. Her ear for untold stories and new ways of telling them has led to creative collaborations with archivists and neuroscientists, as well as innovations in artistic form. Nicola is also a highly regarded radio dramatist, with BBC Radio 4 productions including Have Your Cake, Tony and Rose, Euston to Whitechapel and Abdication, The Crisis of Wallace Simpson. And it's radio we're discussing today, specifically the distinctive nature of radio drama and a commitment we both share to placing women's voices at the heart of our work. So Nicola, can we start by talking a little bit about what route you took into writing and then how that led you into radio drama?
It wasn't particularly a conscious route. I think I'd written two plays which had been on over the space of a couple of years. They were on at Fringe Theatres. And my recollection is that I was approached by a woman who had been a theatre director, but I hadn't worked with her before. She'd seen at least one of the plays and was starting to work in radio as a producer. So it was having a chat with her, and I don't think we necessarily got the first thing we pitched for, but it was through that relationship that I started working for radio.
Right, and compared to the other mediums you've written for, what did radio bring to you or give you that felt different or interesting?
I think it probably took me couple of goes to realise what it was. I do remember that with the first play, I liked the feeling that you could do anything, although I would argue you can go anywhere on stage just as easily. I suppose I liked the feeling of it being like a message in a bottle, because you really don't know who the audience is. You don't know who might be sitting in their car or at home or catch it by accident. So you're writing this story for people to discover. I think I enjoyed that without realising that's what I was enjoying.
And I think there's something about the intimacy of radio as well, isn't there? And the
Absolutely.
Fact that, you know, most people are listening alone in their cars or in their home, as opposed to an audience in theatre.
Yes.
And that gives you, I think, a very different approach to your narrative in a way.
I think that's really true. And I think there are things that you often in the first draft, maybe, of a stage play, I might have quite long speeches that are like monologues, and we'll probably end up cutting those or developing them into a scene or developing them into action. But what surprised me about radio, and I didn't do it in my early plays but then came on to do it more, is that accessing that interior world of the character is something radio does brilliantly. So things that might seem stagey as monologues, in radio, like you say, you're listening on your own, you're listening in a totally different way, and you've got that access inside.
And there's a sense of those characters really talking in your ear, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah. And they don't feel like, as you say, monologues. It feels like you are inhabiting someone's mind and sharing their inner life. And that flow you can get from the internal to the external, in that you can't quite get in theatre in the same way, I think, or film, is that you're just, you know, because of there's no physical aspect to a radio play, there's no staging of a radio play.
No.
You can move in a very fluid way between those states. And I think sometimes just the kind of the constraints of radio in terms of it being 15-minute slots or 45-minute slots. And one way you're writing very specifically to the minute, aren't you?
Yes.
But in another way, it's a completely different approach to dramatising stories when you have relatively small amounts of time in order to sort of pack in your narrative and your character. And I know I found writing for radio, those 15-minute dramas are really kind of liberating in a way that you don't have to structure this two-hour arc, you know, and you can do it in these bite-sized pieces.
I think it's a surprisingly hard thing to learn. I think you do it fantastically. To be able to sculpt time in that way, I think that's what you learn from radio. It's not just about stage space. It's not about the kind of shared audience space you get in theatre. Absolute making time plastic and using it like that.
And somebody said that Radio 4 is the true national theatre. And it's correct, isn't
yes,
it? I can't remember who said it. But it was, 350 original drama productions a year.
Yes.
When you look at the regional reps maybe producing two or three a year, it's an extraordinary resource, isn't it? And an extraordinary art form, really.
That's so true. And, of course, international reach to it with digital radio, that people do listen to your work from anywhere in the world. I think, yeah, that's true about national theatre, because it goes places that theatre can't. You can have large cast things, you can have intimate things, and it's a very level playing field.
Mm. And I think, as female writers, we find ourselves talking about our work is gendered, and I don't know really how I feel about that. There's part of me that thinks the fact that we have to talk about it is a problem, but actually we do want to talk about it, because what we are doing is significant in putting, as you do in all your work, you're very concerned with putting female voices centre stage and talking about women's lives and lived experience, I think, and female heroines, if we might be able to unpack a little bit of that later. And I don't know whether radio drama kind of allows for that in a way that stage and film doesn't. And maybe that's why it's not so critically examined, because it has been traditionally a more female form. I don't know. Maybe it is because it's about in characters' internal lives rather than action and plot. I mean, certainly if you look at the male gaze in film and the fact that there is no objectification of women in radio because it's not a visual medium, and whether that sort of makes it a more of an interesting female-centred form, I don't know.
There's a bunch of interesting points. No, seriously. And yes, I think that thing of the not looking is really powerful, because when you write a female character, you don't think to yourself, she's brunette, she's got blue eyes, she's this, that and the other, she's got a slinky walk. You just write a woman's voice. And radio wonderfully allows you to hear the character of the person you've written through, whether they're breathless, whether they're excitable, whether they're shy, just their character. And it allows us to be neither female or male, but a person relating to other people. I think that is really liberating for women writers. I think radio, because there is no visible entity of the character, just a voice in your head, we empathise far more deeply.
Yes.
So it's very powerful tool for women writers to speak not just to other women, but also say, this is a woman's life, listen to her and feel whatever you feel.
Yes, it's a medium where nothing kind of gets in the way of that, does it? And in a way, we look at Radio 4 drama as a fairly conventional medium, but actually it's radical, and I find a freedom in writing for radio that I don't find anywhere else.
No, I would never want to not write for radio, even through those periods when you feel I'm not getting commissioned or there's other things I'd like to do that seem more fun. But there's something about that intensity, and I think it's primal. And if you imagine, in when people used to live in societies where they had long winter nights and no form of entertainment, and they would all get together in a room in the communal house, in Anglo-Saxon times, and tell stories. And the idea of a narrative that begins with one character and then their journey takes in more things and suddenly becomes the story of the whole community, and we all care what happens and then it ends well or badly. That sense of shared experience is absolutely pure in radio. But I was going to ask you, actually, because you adapted your stage play, the Ruth Ellis one.
I did, yes.
Did you find that actually thinking about it in terms of radio allowed you to just approach slightly differently the way you depicted her?
It did. It was quite interesting in terms of the play's 2 hours long and I had an hour-long radio slot. So consciously the job was sort of compressing that narrative into half of the time. And then realising I kind of did that and nothing was lost from the two-hour play. It seemed incompletely intact as a piece of work. So I think it was about preserving the essence, what was essentially Ruth's story in the play, and taking it into that medium. And again, I was very interested in her internal world and her internal life, and the radio play intensified that in a way that was, I reached for it on stage and I kind of got there, but I really felt I got there in the radio play, and it gave a clarity and a sense of urgency to what I felt essentially was the story of Ruth Ellis. Is, you know, we see Ruth Ellis from the outside and as a historical figure, but also a kind of cultural icon and all that, but actually what it was, what she, who she was at that point in time, came through very strongly.
The essence of them.
Yes, the essence of her and the essence of her trauma, really.
Yes.
There's such a lot on record in books about Ruth Ellis, but also in the police files and the criminal files about her equanimity, as they called it, which was her coldness and her coolness and her sense of detachment. And her statement, her police statement begins, "I am guilty, I'm rather confused," which, you know, if you can't write a play about that, you know, you shouldn't be writing, really. It's the most intriguing of statements. Such that was the opening line, and a couple of hours after committing the murder. So I just wanted to go into inside of that and see what was really going on, because of course when you look back, it's sort of post-traumatic stress disorder probably, and that detachment, and that was used as a way of making her look like a bad mother and all of that. So I felt that radio enabled me to dramatise her inner life in probably more intensely than the stage play. And also the play has Billie Holiday records coming through it in, as a way of articulating what she can't articulate in sort of that suffering and also evoking the period. But Billie Holiday became like a character in the play rather than transitional music on stage.
It's a fantastically elliptical medium, radio, and I completely echo what you said about the more you cut, the more profound and the more distilled it becomes.
Mm.
There's a play I wrote called Seven Scenes that was for The Wire on BBC Radio 3 and was therefore allowed to be more experimental. And it was about a woman whose daughter is abducted and murdered. It was part of a series called Conviction, and the idea for the brief for the writer was something which you would, what is the thing that you would be most powerfully affected by? So it could be a political thing and so on, and I wanted to write about a mother, and particularly about how a mother gets through that for her other kids. But why this is relevant, in particular in relation to time, was I knew that in order to tell such a story and it be possible to listen to at all, using a format, so there's seven scenes and each is 7 minutes long, and they are placed to occur 7 seconds, 7 minutes, 7 hours, 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, 7 years after the initial things happened. So that by distilling it, that rhythm of time makes us be able to go on that journey, which otherwise would be unbearable, and would almost be intrusive, even though it's fictional and they're fictional characters and none of this actually happened. I think that also depends on having a good relationship with the director-producer you're working with. And another thing, as well as women writing for radio, there is some fantastic women working in radio. And if you hit on a good collaborative partner, you can be given a tremendous amount of space and respect as a writer in radio and do really good work in that way, I think.
That's right. And I think there's been a great deal of movement in theatre recently towards women in key positions and key decision-making roles. But that's existed in radio ever since I began, and in a very kind of organic, quiet way, in that I think pretty much all of the producers and directors I've worked with have been women.
Yes.
It's not really up for discussion in radio, isn't it? It just is.
I think from the history of the BBC, you know, there's been women set up the BBC Radiophonic Workshop and the Sound Archive. And from my earliest days of doing radio, there'd often be women sound technicians and grams. So the person that would be doing the sound effects of somebody walking through a tray of sand or knocking things together would often be a woman, and that's a technical role. But, like you say, just women getting on with it and so on.
It's so interesting. I wonder why that is. Is it because it was thought of as a domestic medium? I don't know. Or what is it? Or is it not because it's not a commercial proposition? I've no idea.
I wondered whether, because of what we know of now as Radio 4 grows out of what they used to call the home service, and the idea that during the war it was something that was keeping the home fires burning, and that there was a lot of women who were kind of, would be typing up scripts or collecting together the archive of sound, and maybe it was therefore something that a lot of women did. It's not as well paid as television. You're not as visible doing it as television. Don't know.
No.
Interesting.
There's an academic project in there somewhere.
Definitely.
There's a thesis to be written
yes.
on that, isn't there? How do you feel about being called a female writer? You must be described in those terms.
Yeah, I don't feel like that. I think this is the strangest thing, is when you write, you feel invisible. I like the sense that when I'm working on something, there's this character, there's that character, there's things that I know will happen, but, you know, I'm just as much... in a play I'm working at the moment, I'm just as much George as I am Violet. I'm just as much... they're all part of this story that you're telling. And I don't feel that's how I write. But on another level, totally is how I write. I'm very happy to be called a feminist, because who wouldn't be if he was a woman? But the idea that you write something and you're not writing for one particular audience.
Mm.
You're writing stories, perhaps from a particular point of view, but they are intended to speak to everybody.
Mm. And I always felt, when I started writing, I was writing female-centred plays, if that's what you want to call it, because that was my experience of the world and that's how I perceive the world. And I never thought about having to articulate it or justify it or explain it. And then when you get, you know, you have a play on and you maybe do an interview, people would say, and still say to a certain degree, why do you write about women? Or it's notable that you write all female casts. And then you thought, well, actually, this is... And then it became politicised for me because of
yes.
how it was viewed. But it was never anything I set out to do consciously in a political way.
Yes.
But you then realise what you are saying and doing and kind of make those choices. You know, it seems to me extraordinary now that, say, you know, Be My Baby, which I wrote in the mid-90s and is still performed today and is a cast of 6 women, that's still quite unusual.
Mm.
And it's insane, isn't it, really?
It is. And it's also something which you need to keep opening your eyes to and keep to keep reframing your look so that you see. I happened to watch on TV last night the film of Hellboy because I like the film very much. But you do watch and you think, oh, there is actually just 2 women in this. Often the scene, if you had a breakdown of actually how many characters, named or unnamed, are in there, probably 100 actors in there.
Mm.
And there is a... nice woman who has this unfortunate tendency to burst into flames when she becomes emotional, and then there is also a woman who is a Nazi who is the helper of the baddie. So there is a one good woman and there's one bad woman, and that's it. And you can watch these things as when you're younger, you know, and just follow the story. You ought to be able to follow the story and watch it. If there was just 2 blokes in it and 99 women, it's still a story that you can follow. And yet for some reason, if you do that and you're a woman writer, you're writing female-led stories, whereas everybody else who writes everything else who may or may not be female is just writing stories. And I know we tend to say now, you know, it's only an issue because we're still having to have that conversation. If we need to keep having that conversation, then we just keep having that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I sort of feel, you know, it is part of what I do now. It began unconsciously, but it's now very conscious. And,
yes.
You know, I will sort of feel like I own that. If they want to say female playwright, okay, I'll own that and I'll be that as
yes.
big as I can
yes.
until it doesn't become important anymore.
Yes.
Also, what I'm kind of interested to talk about a little bit is if you're kind of broadening your reach into science, aren't you? Because you're working with, is it geneticists and healthcare scientists?
Yes.
Which is... an interesting and unusual collaboration, I would say. So be fascinated to know a bit more about that.
I've always been quite interested in writing about science. And going back a few years, I've written plays for theatre and education companies which have had science themes, funded by Wellcome and so forth. And writing for radio, I've done, I suppose, plays, Tony and Rose and also Euston to Whitechapel, both had... a medical science theme, and I'm now working with healthcare scientists on a couple of projects. You know, it's an ongoing thing that we'll be doing from time to time. I think partly it's because what medical science does is it ups the stakes. So purely clear-eyed, looking at it as a dramatist, any time when your characters are under pressure for whatever reason is interesting. We empathise with people because wherever we are in walks of life, we all get ill, we all have, the, you know, there's very few things that we happen, we're born, we may or may not have children, we get ill, we die, you know, we lose people that are close to us. So there's something very humanising about remembering that. Also, I'm really fascinated in language and I'm interested in the stakes that make things important, and eavesdropping on the language and stakes of another world, collaborating with scientists and learning about their world, what's important to them, that's interesting too. I also think that playwriting, because it is very functional, you know, it's not like spooling off words and that will add up to something that's true, and that's a very, very insulting way to talk about prose, but I mean, it's all about structure, isn't it, with plays, and it's all about, if there is a character, that the play will only work if you actually make certain things work.
Yes.
And that, having done a project where healthcare scientists were involved in creating the drama, and they were very resistant to the idea of doing anything arty, they found that as scientists, they got dramatic writing quite easily.
Really?
Because they knew that there were certain elements you had to put in, there had to be an outcome, there had to be a shape, and them talking about the consequences and the remedies and the symptoms and features and stuff that might happen in someone getting ill transpose quite well to drama.
That's really interesting. And yeah, drama is kind of scientific and about engineering as well, isn't it, in a way? And all of those sort of, it requires a logical mind.
It does. Mm. And I think that that drama ultimately is about the logic of the story and collaboration, because you collaborate with the directors, you collaborate with your actors. It's a communal entertainment and, logic, collaboration.
On that note, that seems a perfect way to say thank you very much, Nicola Baldwin.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Nicola Baldwin in conversation with Amanda Whittington. You can find out more about Nicola on her website at www.nicolabaldwin.eu. And that concludes episode 292, which was recorded by Amanda Whittington and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 293, Becca Heddle speaks with Jane Draycott about African tales, cloning, and bold work for younger readers. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.